From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Robert E. Lee might have commanded the armies of either side in the Civil War. He chose Virginia and the South, became the iconic commanding general of the Confederacy. Lee's personal dignity, even nobility, became grounds for reconciliation after the nation's bloodiest war. But there is still complexity and controversy aplenty in his story. This hour, On Point, a big new biography by Michael Korda looks at Robert E. Lee and the American Civil War. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How should we remember Robert E. Lee? Martyr, hero, traitor? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by University of Virginia historian Gary Gallagher. There is still debate over Lee and slavery, strategy, more. We will hear it. There is the sound of that voice depicted in many ways down through the 150 years now since the Civil War. Here's a little bit from the 2003 film Gods and Generals, Robert E. Lee, played by Robert Duvall, refusing an offer to command the Union Army.
Sir, would you please convey my deepest sense of honor and gratitude to the President, but I must decline his offer. Please tell him, please be clear. I have never taken my duties lightly, but I have no greater duty than to my home, to Virginia.
Robert E. Lee from Gods and Generals, and the voice there of Robert Duvall. Joining me from New York is Michael Korda, author of the new biography, Clouds of Glory, The Life and Legend of Robert E. Lee. You can read an excerpt of his latest at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Korda was longtime editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster. He's written biographies of Ulysses S. Grant, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Michael Korda, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Small thing, but not so small. Just in this week, we have the observance of the 150th anniversary of Arlington National Cemetery. That was the Lee family home, Robert E. Lee's home across the Potomac from the Capitol. Did he live there? How did it come into his family, his realm?
He married the daughter of George Washington Parke Custis, who was the adopted son of George Washington. And when Custis died, his house passed to Robert E. Lee and to Mrs. Lee. Robert E. Lee spent there probably the most domestic and the happiest years, I would judge, of his life. And, of course, for Mrs. Lee, Arlington, which at any rate from the outside is one of the grandest of grand southern mansions, Mrs. E. Lee was deeply attached to every bit of it and to every acre of its land, and bitterly unhappy when it was seized by the Union Army in 1861.
In the 150 years since the end of the Civil War, of course, it has become such a beautiful, beautiful and treasured resting place for so many Americans from all parts of the country. Michael Korda, here, of all the people in all the world to write about, now you write about Robert E. Lee. You've been in Civil War territory before with Ulysses S. Grant. You know, I wonder how you end up looking. There's so much to learn about him, but we ask our listeners on Facebook, how should we remember Robert E. Lee? And the range is there immediately. You know, here's boom, a traitor to the United States. Boom, a man who stood by his state, the Old Dominion. How do you look at him?
I think he is a traitor is perhaps a heavily loaded word, and I would not use that. I look on him as a hero, as a man of incredible courage and dignity, and a man who, when faced at last with the choice, made the only choice he could. I don't think that Lee would have fought for secession itself. He called secession a silly idea and was opposed to it. He would not have fought for slavery. He himself, in his own words, before the war, described slavery as a moral and political evil in every country. He fought for the principle that the federal government should not impose its ideas and its will by force of arms upon any state or upon the inhabitants of any state, in particular Virginia, which was his own state. I think that attaching to Lee a whole variety of ideas which he did not, in fact, necessarily share is a mistake.
traitor as a heavily loaded word, and it certainly is. Hero is also a freighted word and a beloved word. Why do you hesitate on the, you know, we'll look at both sides of that nickel. But here's a man who led enormous forces against the United, you know, against the Union. How does that not constitute a traitor's behavior?
I don't see, though I am not myself a Confederate sympathizer, you understand, or a Southerner, I don't see taking arms in 1861 as treason. I see it as just what it was, a rebellion and a civil war against the notion that the federal government could change the ideas, the institutions, and the independence of the Southern states. Discussing now 150 years later whether they were right to take that view or whether they were right to secede is in some ways a waste of time. I mean, they did. Lee was not in favor of secession, but he was passionately determined not to lead an army against his own people and his own state, or, as he put it himself, to raise his sword against his own children. And also believed very strongly that whatever right the federal government did have, that did not include the right to use force against Virginia.
Many in his own family and close to him in his family chose the other way. What was it in Robert E. Lee's background that put him, his immediate circle, so much on the fence, on the line about which way their loyalty should go in the Civil War?
Well, I think many is perhaps overloading it. His sister, his beloved sister, chose the North, Mrs. Marshall, and Mrs. Marshall's son actually fought and reached the rank of colonel in the Union Army. The majority of the Lee family fought for the Confederacy, and certainly all Lee's sons did.
Looking at Samuel Phillips Lee, a cousin, I guess, was a Union Navy admiral, John Fitzgerald Lee, judge advocate of the Union Army.
It's a big family.
Mm-hmm.
But in Lee's direct family, the person who concerned him most and to whom he wrote the most eloquent letter when he decided to resign from the United States Army and not to accept command of it was his sister, Mrs. Marshall, whom he adored. And was the one person whose judgment he would have regretted.
You open the book, the biography, big biography, Clouds of Glory, of Robert E. Lee, with the story of him going after John Brown. As much as I've read, I just had never focused on this story. It never registered that Colonel Lee, Robert E. Lee at that time, led the Union, of course, forces who captured John Brown.
He did indeed. I wanted to begin Clouds of Glory with that story because, for one thing, it's the point at which the country we can now see came close to a division into two parts, that it should be Lee appointed to lead the federal troops to put down John Brown's raid on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry is ironic, but it's also emblematic of everything that was to come. And I am very, very passionate to recreate that moment, that very brief moment, when John Brown and Robert E. Lee were together in the same small room. To me, that was the only way to begin the book. In fact, that scene seemed to me the reason to write the book in the first place. It's an extraordinary moment in American history when these two men whose ideas were so different, but who in many ways were remarkably similar, the one a Virginian aristocrat, the other a New England hardscrabble farmer and cattle merchant, both of them believing that they were doing their duty.
One an abolitionist, the other with slaves in the family.
Well, the other with slaves in the family, but less important than that at that moment was that Lee was an agent of the federal government. He was a colonel in the United States Army. He represented law and order. And both of them were men of extraordinary dignity, courage, eloquence, passion. And the notion of them standing together in 1859 in the same small room and meeting one another seems to me the preface to the whole story of the Civil War and to the whole story of what became of Lee's life.
Are you surprised at the aura of nobility that seemed to come so early to Lee after the war, after the great conflict ended? Or was that necessary somehow to reconciliation?
I think both are true. Let me say, first of all, that I think Lee always projected without any specific effort or without necessarily meaning to do so, an enormous dignity and an enormous sense of energy, but also of morality and strength of mind. He had that as a cadet at West Point, and it was remarked by people. He was called then the Marble Man. So I think that was with him almost from childhood, partly because his father, though a great cavalry general and a protege of Washington's, had led a difficult political career and a ruinous financial one. Lee set himself to the task of reversing those things in himself and became this enormously powerful figure.
The new biography is Clouds of Glory. Michael Korda, forgive me. We've got a break coming right up here. Listeners, you can join us. How do you think now of Robert E. Lee? 800-423-TALK. This is On Point.
Then cheer, boys, cheer. Raise a joyous shout. For Arkansas and North Carolina now have both gone out. And let another rousing cheer for Tennessee be given. The single star of the bonny blue flag has grown to be 11.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about General Robert E. Lee in the Civil War and beyond, the complex American icon. He is the subject of Michael Korda's new biography, Clouds of Glory, The Life and Legend of Robert E. Lee. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Of course, he was ultimately, maybe above all, a military commander. Here's the climax of the 1993 film Gettysburg. Lieutenant General James Longstreet, played by Tom Berenger, listens as General Robert E. Lee, played by Martin Sheen, decides his strategy. Here Lee is describing an attack on the center of the Union line, famously known as Pickett's Charge. It failed. It's considered by many to be one of Robert E. Lee's greatest mistakes.
In the center, they will break.
Sir?
They will break in the center. Those people will be gaining men from all directions, guns by the thousands, and Richmond has nothing left to send us. So if we stay, we fight. If we retreat now, we will have fought here for 2 days and will leave knowing we could not drive him off. And I have never yet left the enemy in command of the field. No, sir. Retreat is no longer an option.
Martin Sheen in Gettysburg. Michael Korda joins us from New York. University of Virginia historian Gary Gallagher joins us in a moment from Charlottesville. You can join us as well, 800-423-8255. The Civil War was lost. Lee was the commander. What's your assessment ultimately of his military decisions in that long war, many battles? What's the sum you come to when you assess this general, Michael Korda?
Best general America ever produced. That is not to say that he did not make mistakes. Every general does. And Gettysburg, I think, was one of them. Although in Clouds of Glory, I give Lee's reasons for fighting at Gettysburg. It was not something he wanted to do, and it was not a place he wanted to fight. But nevertheless, as he looked over the terrain and as he realized that Meade and the Union Army were close to him, he had no option but to fight. I think there is in Lee something that people miss, and that is behind that distinguished and extremely polite mask, that veneer of enormously good manners. There was a ferocity of spirit that is equaled by perhaps no other American general. And it's one of the most interesting things about Lee is that although self-contained always, and although not given to passionate displays in any way, I can think of no other American general who was so aggressive, who fought so aggressively, and who very, very, very seldom was ever called upon to retreat. I admire him enormously as a general. I admire him, too, as a human being. I think his spirit, his dignity, in a position that he disliked from the beginning, in a cause about which he was doubtful as late as 1861, all of these were tragic, and all of those things preyed upon his mind. I don't think that once he had made his decision, he had huge reservations that made him sleepless at night. Once he decided to do something, he did it. But he did it, I think, with a great reluctance and great sadness, and that shows up in his character again and again, and above all at the end.
Mm. Plenty of controversy and historical debate still around Robert E. Lee. We will hear some of that in just a moment with Gary Gallagher from the University of Virginia and Michael Korda. Calls first, if I may, Jared in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Jared, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
As an African American, and also as someone who loves history, you know, I feel kind of conflicted about it. But I think the best way to look at someone like Robert E. Lee and the whole Confederate cause is you know, an even-handed kind of way. They did have legitimate grievances that weren't about slavery. You know, and not every person, you know, who fought in the Civil War, and obviously Robert E. Lee, you know, not every single person, you know, had the horrendous views. Of African Americans, but at the same time, you know, we have to realize that a significant part of that of the war was about slavery, and so I think we should be careful not to deify them, but we should also be careful not to try and erase history. I know there are some people that want to, you know, rid town squares of statues of him, or even want to change, you know, the name of Washington and Lee University. I think we shouldn't go that far as to try and, you know, whitewash history or try and you know, erase that. I think it's an important thing that we should talk about. But at the same time, you know, we should be careful not to deify him and be sensitive to what Robert E. Lee and what the Confederacy means to a lot of people, especially people of color.
Yeah, Jared, you're a very generous reader of history. Robert E. Lee, of course, certainly tempts deification. There's no question. Let me get one more, and we'll come to that and more. Robin in Franklin, Tennessee. Robin, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. My comment is I have a hard time viewing Lee as a hero, even though he might have been a great general, because I view him more as a coward. If he himself knew and admitted that slavery was morally wrong, but he didn't have the inner strength to stand up for that belief, and I believe that's how most great atrocities occur, people who have good ideas but just are passive in doing anything about it. And it reminds me of a quote that I'm paraphrasing from Albert Einstein, that the world is a dangerous place, not because there's so many evil people, but so many people who do nothing about it. And that will ultimately be my opinion of Lee.
Robin, I'm so grateful for your call as well. Those are both great. Michael Korda, if I may, I think it's a good place right there to bring in Please Stand By on New York. The book is Clouds of Glory. Historian Gary Gallagher is good enough to join us right now from Charlottesville, Virginia, professor of history at the University of Virginia. Gary Gallagher, thank you very much for being with us today.
Happy to be here.
Hi, Gary.
It's great to have you both. Robin in Tennessee is not ready to look past the issue of, in effect, fighting or explicitly fighting ultimately for slavery. Michael Korda talks about Robert E. Lee's ambivalence about slavery. How do you see his position on slavery, Gary Gallagher?
I think he had very conventional views of slavery for someone of his time and place. He's part of the slaveholding aristocracy of the Old South, and I think one of his real loyalties, he had a fierce loyalty to Virginia, a very strong loyalty to the United States as well, but he also had a loyalty to the slaveholding South. And he believed that the institution of slavery, the whole social structure associated with slavery, was the best way to order relations between the races, as he said. He had absolute contempt for abolitionists, loathed them. And I think an indication of how strongly he felt about this came in his reaction to the Emancipation Proclamation in January 1863, just a few days after Lincoln issued it. He wrote a very strong letter to the Confederate Secretary of War saying that this was one of the most horrific things that he could imagine, and it threatened everything worth defending about the Confederacy and the slaveholding South.
Michael Korda, do you think we have reason to look more kindly on Robert E. Lee on the slavery front, his stance?
Well, I think it must be said that Lee and Mrs. Lee, having inherited a large number of slaves, 200, I believe, almost exactly, set about freeing them in 5 years, as her father's will set up, and also went to the trouble of educating them to read and write, even though that was against the law in Virginia. I think Lee's view of slavery was that of a conservative Southerner of his time. We make a great mistake in attempting to judge the figures of the past by the opinions of the present.
Why is that such a – in this case, that, I mean, the opinions of the present may have been fairly vividly represented in abolitionists, who he knew well, and Gary Gallagher says rejected. I mean, as a well-educated and worldly man of the South, yes, but he was he knew the full spectrum of views.
Yes, and disliked slavery intensely. He expressed himself very strongly about his discomfort, morally and in many other ways, with inheriting this number of slaves from his father-in-law, and he and his wife determined to carry out the liberation of those slaves within the 5 years specified in his father-in-law's will, right, and did so, even though by that time the Civil War was raging so that it was no longer necessary to do. So I don't think you can say that Robert E. Lee was in favor of slavery. He expressed himself very strongly against it often, but he was in favor and fought in favor of not revolutionizing or overturning the institutions of the South.
How did he see slavery? Did he want it to be gone, Michael Korda? If so, how was that to happen?
He believed that that it would go in time, that it would go gradually, and that it could not and should not be forced upon the South by arms. I'm not sure that I agree with that, by the way. But his opinion was, again, very firmly expressed. He looked forward to slavery's removal, but he did not wish to see it imposed quickly or forcibly upon the South.
Professor Gallagher, how do you hear that depiction of Robert E. Lee as someone who firmly disliked slavery intensely?
Well, the letter that Mr. Korda quoted for the antebellum letter is certainly, it does have that sentiment in it, that Lee said that it was wrong. He believed it was wrong in any society, but he also said that he didn't think human beings should do anything about it, that in his own time, God would get rid of slavery. And in the meantime, I think there's no doubt, and I think we probably agree on this, that he believed that the slaveholding social structure that was in place was the kind of structure that made the most sense to order a biracial society. I mean, I think the evidence on that point is overwhelming, that he was extremely uncomfortable with the notion, especially, of any forced change in those social arrangements in the antebellum South or later in the Confederacy, and his reaction to the Emancipation Proclamation, I think, underscores that.
So should we look...
I would agree with that, by the way.
Yeah. Should we look upon him then, Professor Gallagher, with a certain special dispensation on the slavery front because he was a thoughtful man who was conflicted?
Well, I'm not sure whether special dispensation is the right way to put it. I'll say again, I think he was very much... Mm. Man of his time and place. And his attitude toward abolitionists would have been not only common in the antebellum South, but would have been very common in much of the free part of the United States. Abolitionists were seen as extremists who threatened the Union by many people north of the Potomac and Ohio rivers as well. But I think we need to be very careful. There was a strong effort after the Civil War by writers of the Lost Cause school who were trying to get their interpretation of the Confederacy in place to present Lee as an almost proto-abolitionist, and I think that's absolutely not right. I mean, they tried to distance him from slavery retrospectively because they knew slavery tainted, before the bar of history, so to speak, the Confederate cause. And so they focused on Lee. He was their best card to play by far. And one of the things they argued about him was that he was really anti-slavery. I think that doesn't get at the historical Lee, except in a very theoretical way.
Let me go to Lee, calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Lee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
So my name is Lee, and I am named after the Lees of Virginia. And every woman in my family has, or in my mother's family, has Lee as a middle name. And I think that the...
Are you a descendant of Robert E. Lee or his family?
I'm a direct descendant of Light Horse Harry Lee.
His father?
Yes.
Okay.
And I just don't think that we can underestimate, you know, how deep the cultural attachment to his example of stalwartness and, exactly as Professor Corso said, the ability to be both passionate and restrained at the same time. That piece is so strong. And it really, I have to say, in some sense outweighs his view on a specific political issue or a specific time or battle.
The example of character. Let us pick that up. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael Korda, there was the Lost Cause School. Professor Gallagher reminds us there was an effort, some would call it, at whitewashing or certainly putting in best light after the war. That depiction of Lee as the passionate, restrained, stalwart in the most exalted terms, is that a result of post-war propaganda or simply deserved?
Well, I think that there was a post-war tendency, as Professor Gallagher calls it, the Lost Cause school, that certainly began burnishing Lee's image to a glossy perfection immediately after the war. Lee himself had nothing to do with that and probably would not have wished it to be done. Nevertheless, I think that the striking thing about Lee is that he can't be judged by our standards of today. To seek in Lee all the things that were good qualities and to also ask of him that he should have been a secret abolitionist or have our view of racial equality is to ask of him something which would have been impossible in any Southerner of his class at that time and was impossible for a great many people in the North. So it's not that he should get a pass for his view on slavery or his view on race relations. It's that does not play as huge a role in Lee's life as we now feel ourselves or as we now would like him to have felt. We are tending to judge Lee as if he were alive today and sharing our feelings 150 years later. He did not. He had his own very strong feelings of 150 years ago.
It was an enormous conflict. So many Americans died. You can understand the tendency then and now to put a preferenced cast around characters there. Gary Gallagher, did the North accept the polished Lee reputation that was put forward in part to find a path toward reconciliation?
I think that people of the mid-19th century found in Lee very attractive qualities, including many in the free states, in the United States, mm-hmm. as I would call it, during the Civil War, especially among the Democrats. At the time Lee died in 1870, years after the war, there were a number of very positive obituaries of him in northern newspapers. It upset a lot of people, such as Frederick Douglass. So it's a phenomenon that really transcended section in some ways, this favorable view of Lee.
Gary Gallagher at the University of Virginia, please stand by there. Michael Korda, the new biography is Clouds of Glory, The Life and Legend of Robert E. Lee. Listeners, you can join us. Did we have to agree to give him honor in part to get back together as a country? And how do you read Robert E. Lee now? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Little Waylon Jennings here with Rebel Soldier, a song that dates back to the Civil War. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Left on the fields alone, I am a rebel soldier, and far from my home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about General Robert E. Lee in the Civil War and beyond, the complex American icon. Michael Korda, a biographer of Ulysses S. Grant and Dwight D. Eisenhower, has brought a new telling of the story to us in his new book, Clouds of Glory, The Life and Legend of Robert E. Lee. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. He joins us today from New York. Gary Gallagher, professor of history at the University of Virginia, author of Becoming Confederates, Lee and His Army, The Union War, Lee and His Generals in War and Memory, The Confederate War, joins us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Just a little more from the 1993 film Gettysburg, Robert E. Lee, played by Martin Sheen, Robert E. Lee, student of Napoleon, discussing strategy.
The attack will be preceded by massed artillery. We'll concentrate all of our guns on that one small area. A foot on fire, as Napoleon would call it. When the artillery has had its effect, your charge will break the line.
Of course, he did not find victory at Gettysburg, had to fight his way out. Gary Gallagher, Michael Korda calls Robert E. Lee the best general the United States has ever produced. What do you say, sir?
Well, I think he was a very fine general, and I agree with Mr. Korda entirely on the element of Lee's military personality, which always emphasized the aggressive. A word they used during the war a lot to apply to him was audacity. He was extremely audacious. He was extremely aggressive. And that kind of generalship, I think it was successful in many ways. It also incurred huge casualties on the part of the men in his army. Grant's known as the butcher in many quarters, but Lee's the bloodiest general in American history in terms of the percentage of his men who got shot. His style of generalship yielded great successes that lifted morale across the Confederacy and depressed morale in the United States, which was the key to who would win the war in many ways, but it was extremely costly.
I've got a comment here from our listener I'd like to put to both of you, Michael Korda, Gary Gallagher. This is from Andrew, writes to us, says, this is not a fan of Lee's generalship. He says, can you address the myth of Lee being a great general? Pickett's charge at Gettysburg should be called Lee's charge, used tactics that were outdated decades before. Any general that didn't pick up on the outdatedness earlier realized how outdated they were after the first few battles of the Civil War. And then there's this, writes, then there's Lee's decision to fight on after Lincoln was reelected. Fighting a losing war before the election perhaps could be justified. Had Lincoln lost, the North might have given up. But after Lincoln was reelected, the North wasn't giving up, and Lee simply wasted the lives of his men and the lives of other men. Michael Korda, what to say to those two angles of critique?
Well, I deal in clouds of glory with each of Lee's battles. Gettysburg is singled out because he lost it, although it has to be said that he won the first 2 days of it, even though by a very narrow margin. Pickett's charge failed him on the third day. But one has to balance that against his great victories, such as Fredericksburg and Second Manassas, or his brilliant handling of a then-improvised and rather hastily put together and trained army in the 7 days battles that freed Richmond from the threat of being taken by the Union forces when they were only 6 miles away from Richmond. Mm. There has been no other American general that fought with such audacity, as Professor Gallagher quite rightly calls it, with such spirit and with such intensity and with such swift movement as Lee. I think that taking him all in all, it would be hard to find a general who fought more brilliantly or with more daring and originality than Robert E. Lee.
What about these critiques, Gary Gallagher? Gettysburg, the Pickett's charge as a big mistake, and fighting on after Lincoln's reelection as a waste.
Well, Lee certainly made mistakes, and the Pickett, Pettigrew, or Longstreet's fault, whatever you want to call it, was one of them. But I think it's important to keep in mind that every major general on both sides during the Civil War resorted to those kinds of frontal assaults, including Grant at Cold Harbor and even James Longstreet at Knoxville in 1863. Longstreet's often put forward, especially by those who read Killer Angels or see the movie Gettysburg, as someone who understood you shouldn't launch frontal assaults. Well, Longstreet did that as well. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. In terms of stopping the war, Lee was an army commander. It was not within Lee's sphere of power to stop the war after Lincoln was reelected. That's a political decision within the context of a democratic republic, which the Confederacy was, just as the United States was. So he works for civilian superiors, and civilian superiors decide questions regarding whether the war will continue or not.
Paul in North Branford, Connecticut. Hey. Thank you for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was calling because we were taught that Lee was a very intelligent person and he was a good general, that there were good people and bad people on both sides of the war.
Did your family fight in the war, your ancestors?
My grandfather was in the 20th Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
He was wounded and taken prisoner at Chancellorsville.
Mm.
He was sent back because he was so badly wounded. He recovered and went on with his life. He never had a bad word about the rebels. And he married an Army nurse that he met in the hospital.
So do you continue to have that generous view of Robert E. Lee today?
Yeah, and I think my siblings would agree. We maintain there was good and bad. If he had stayed on the Union side, the war would have been a lot shorter. The Union lacked good leadership. They had the superiority in manufacturing and in personnel, but they lacked good leadership. Had he stayed on this side, the war would have been a lot shorter, in my opinion.
Paul, I appreciate your call. Michael Korda, do you see any glimmer of the possibility in his history that he might have done that, stayed on the Union side?
I think that when command of the new army of 75,000 men was being raised was offered to Lee by Francis Blair, that there must have been somewhere in Lee's mind a moment of elation and even of confusion. He had been 36 years in the United States Army. Mm-hmm. It had taken him that time to reach the rank of colonel. He had just been named a full colonel by President Lincoln. And he saw being offered to him the thing that he never thought would happen in his life, which was wearing a general star. But given
his
feelings,
if he just took command of the Union Army, it would be his right there.
Yes. It was right there. It was offered to him, everything he'd spent 36 years to achieve. But it's to Lee's credit, to his honor, that he did not accept what he knew he could not accept morally, and that was to use force against his own state and, as he put it, his own children. There was never the slightest chance that he could have accepted it, but it must have been a very peculiar feeling for Lee to be offered a general star almost simultaneously by both armies. He was offered a brigadier general's rank in the Confederate Army. Several days later, he was offered a major general's rank in the United States Army and command of 75,000 men that were being raised. Think what that must have been like for a man who had spent 36 years from West Point to being a colonel.
Gary Gallagher, you're in Virginia. Not every top soldier from Virginia went to the South. I'm reading here from Elizabeth Brown Pryor. She's writing about how Lee went to his mentor, General Winfield Scott, who was Army Commander-in-Chief of the United States Army. Scott, she writes, though a proud Virginian, had dismissed as an insult any hint that he himself would turn from the United States. When Lee offered to sit out the troubles at home, at his home in Arlington, we've talked about that today, the general told him bluntly, "I have no place in my army for equivocal men." Lee went back to Arlington to contemplate his options. Not everyone from Virginia turned south, Gary Gallagher. Was there ever a chance Lee might not have?
Oh, I think in Lee's, I would agree with Mr. Korda that in Lee's case, he was going to go with Virginia. And Winfield Scott is often put forward as an example of someone from Virginia who didn't. But it ran much deeper than that. Not almost a third of all the Virginia-born officers in the United States Army remained loyal to Virginia mm-hmm. during the war. It wasn't just Scott and George Thomas and a handful. And I think this is a perfect way to get at the different kinds of loyalties that people had in the mid-19th century. Lee's loyalty to the United States, I think his loyalty to Virginia trumped that during the secession crisis. But during the war, his loyalty to Virginia became much less important than his loyalty to the Confederacy. He became an ardent Confederate, and whenever the needs of any state clashed with those of the Confederate national effort, he always came down on the side of the national effort, including with things such as conscription, which was very controversial during the war.
What about after the war, Gary Gallagher, Lee's role, his attitude?
Well, I think Lee behaved impeccably in public after the war. He called for the former Confederates to accept defeat, to look forward, don't dwell on the past, don't nourish feelings of bitterness. Privately, he seethed about what was going on. He hated what the radical Republicans were doing with Reconstruction. He was very upset with the interventions in Southern society, the former slaveholding society and so forth. So there are really two Lees after the war, the one whose face was there for the public to see, which was very reconciliationist and getting on with reunion, and the private Lee who was very unhappy with what was transpiring.
Ava in Albany, Kentucky. Ava, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that considering that the rebel flag, the Stars and Bars, which is Lee's battle flag, and I also live in a city where the Confederate flag itself is flown, but the Stars and Bars are a symbol of racism, are a symbol to all racists in this country. And I believe that whitewashing Lee's history to be a better man than his cause only encourages and contributes to what is becoming rampant racism in this country.
Ava, you make a powerful point. I'd like to hear both of our guests on that. Michael Korda, how about it? To present him as a better man than his cause encourages racism in this country. What do you say to that?
Well, of course, that all depends what you think his cause was. I don't think
he was the commanding general of the Confederacy.
Yes. I don't... What has become of the Stars and Bars, let me say first of all, is not necessarily what people felt about the Stars and Bars between 1861 and 1865. I don't suppose that Lee looked on the flag as a symbol of racism. He looked on the flag as a symbol of resistance against overweening federal authority used against the states by force of arms. We can now attach to his behavior feelings that we've acquired over the past 150 years, but that's not to say that Lee felt them in the same way 150 years ago. So I think that it is possible to be a great man in a bad cause. In fact, Grant said that of Lee that nobody ever fought harder in a worse cause, and that may well be true. But I think that he was a great man whose life is worth studying and a man of genuine, powerful feelings of loyalty and a man driven by intense religious and moral feelings is hardly possible to deny. Clouds of Glory is nearly 800 pages long, and I think every time that I quote one of Lee's letters, I'm moved by the strength of his feeling and his absolute belief in the justice of what he was doing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Gary Gallagher, what about Ava's very challengingly put observation that she says, again, it's wrong to present a man as better than his cause. It encourages racism in the country. What do you say, Gary?
Well, I have a couple of reactions to that. The first one is that she's absolutely right. You can't distance what she calls the Stars and Bars, which is not really the St. Andrew's Cross battle flag. Mm-hmm. Is not the Stars and Bars, but that flag cannot be separated from slavery and from, I mean, it just can't. That no matter what anybody might try to argue, it can't. That's just a fact, and people should stop trying to do that. On the second part of it, I mean, virtually no one who was alive in the United States in the mid-19th century would even come close to meeting what we would consider to be an acceptable standard regarding race. I mean, by our standards, virtually everybody was deeply prejudiced, including many abolitionists, incidentally.
You can dig into Abraham Lincoln's writing and come out with plenty.
Absolutely. My students are often, they read some of Lincoln and they're... They can't believe that Lincoln said some of the things he said. So it's really important to try to engage with these people within the context of their own times, I think. That doesn't mean we have to approve of it. And for me, the point isn't whether you really like somebody or don't like them. It's an attempt to try to understand them. But I think it's important to seek that understanding, to just accept that they are not going to meet our standards. Virtually no one is, just as we won't in 50 years meet people's. Nothing's easier than judging people who've been dead 150 years.
It's a long time. Michael Korda, right in the front piece, you quote the famous quote from William Faulkner, "The past is never dead, it's not even past." Which part of this story, for you, is not past, Michael Korda?
I think what's not passed is the courage, the sincerity, and the strong feelings with which the South fought. That is not to say, since I'm not a Southerner, that I'm passing judgment on which side is right and which side is wrong. In writing Clouds of Glory, I'm attempting to provide a portrait of the man as he was. I think an admirable and extremely interesting figure and giant figure in American history. I would agree with Professor Gallagher that we cannot judge the past by the standards of the present when it comes to anybody, and we will ourselves be judged in the same stringent way by people 100 to 150 years after us.
Maybe you're right, maybe we can't, though this war certainly drew a very, very bright and ultimately bloody line through the country. People on both sides and Robert E. Lee right at the head of the military from the South. Michael Korda writes the story in a big new biography, 800 pages, as he says, Clouds of Glory, The Life and Legend of Robert E. Lee. There's a big excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Korda, thank you very much for spending some time with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Gary Gallagher, professor of history at the University of Virginia, author of Becoming Confederates, Paths to a New National Loyalty. Gary Gallagher, thank you so much for your time as well.
Thanks for inviting me.
Go out with Karen Elson and the Secret Sisters, kind of a melancholy version of Dixie. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
In Dixieland, I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. Away, away.